Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Bald Move Television Podcast. We're the officially unofficial podcast for all of television. I am your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And we are, as we have been for many, many weeks now, delving into the final season of David Simon's The Deuce. This is for episode 306, This Trust Thing. Mm-hmm. It is Trust Thing we got going on here. Jim, what did you think of this episode?
This episode has maybe, definitely the defining scene of the season, but one of the best scenes in the entire series. Eileen sort of, you know, proxy explaining the way she grew up and some of the events in her life is truly outstanding. Maggie Gyllenhaal just crushes that scene in you know, the way she has through this entire series.
I was just thinking back that, like, over the years, hasn't she always had, like, this kind of episode 6-7, like,
that scene with her brother
monologue
from season one just fucking floored me.
Well, and her going hard after, wasn't it Rodney?
The Pip
is trying to kind of, like, own her after she took that beating. Uh-huh. She does a lot of anchoring work on the show.
And then, obviously, the Tommy Rudy thing, man. I knew things were about to explode. I just didn't really know what was going to happen there. And I think this is the worst possible outcome.
Yeah, because now it's like, it feels like a lot of other outcomes are preordained.
They could be.
We'll talk about that when we get there. But yeah, and the way they, in this episode, I'm like, maybe Rudy will do just enough. Maybe he will have enough chips to push them all in on one, you know, and then, of course, he didn't.
Yeah.
It was tough. I felt like there's a lot of interesting inversions. Like, I thought it was interesting, you know, Lori's old pimp, Cece, like, infamously cut a bitch in season one. It was really gruesome. And then Lori, like, cuts a bitch in this episode.
Uh-huh.
And the way he's like, you cut me. I thought that was interesting, kind of like her turning the tables. But on the other hand, it's also a lot of like impotent shows of power.
Yeah.
Like her smoke, you know, like taking her one last cigarette as she's completely retreating on all other fronts. There's a lot of, what was another one? Like Rudy. Rudy slapping Longo around. Another display of someone who is already past the prime, over the hill, no longer useful to the economic system that they're participating in. So much thematic stuff and great acting and great storytelling and writing. Do we want to talk more in generalities? We want to dig right into this episode.
I want to get right into it.
Before we continue in the podcast, a little bit of Bald Move housekeeping. Last Friday, Netflix released the Vince Gilligan directed and written El Camino, a little Breaking Bad epilogue for one Jesse Pinkman. As you probably know, we have every single second of Breaking Bad footage podcasted for posterity, so you know we had to gear up for one last ride with Jesse. That podcast dropped this Monday, so if you're jonesing for some of that old school Breaking Bad meth, give it a snort or a smoke. You know, whatever. Over on Pickle Me This, we're hard on the Rick and Morty Season 3 grind we release every Tuesday. This week we're talking rest and Rick laxation with the author of The Science of Rick and Morty, Matt Brady. Check it out. The American Horror Story Season 9, 1984 season continues. Cecily and I are covering that. It's honestly on an epic, unprecedented run of awesomeness. If you like 1980s slasher films, if you have nostalgia for 80s horror, I really encourage you to check it out. The great thing about American Horror is you can just jump in whenever because it's all an anthology. So if that sounds like a good time, check that out on the American Horror Story podcast feed. Mr. Robot's coming back strong, and we've got the final season coverage with episodes also released on Wednesdays. Cecil and I are also doing this thing we call the Cinematic Spooktacular over on the Bald Movies feed. This is the third one that we've done. We're subtitling it The Search for Spook. We had the first one drop last week. Another one will come out on October 20th, and then the final one October 30th, Halloween Eve. On the Bald Movies feed, we're also covering Zombieland 2 Double Tap this week. And finally, we have a new feature. We just crossed a major milestone, 5 years of lunches with Jim and Aaron for our club members. And to celebrate, every Thursday, we're releasing a lunch out of that archive for free to the public, which we're calling Lunch with Jim and Aaron Reheated. If you've ever been curious about what a lunch is all about, check it out. Plus, it's a fun little window in Bald Move history. I used to have hair, kind of, on top of my head. I was trying. check that out in on baldmove.com. Okay, well, I'm going to start off with the topic of Eileen. As you mentioned, it's probably the juiciest storyline with, and there's a lot of juice in these here storylines. It opens with her like kind of watching this waitress work for tips and kind of like in this gross and obvious way that still to this day, if you're a waitress or a bartender or any woman really that works in a hospitality related field or any woman in the world can relate to this. And it's a linchpin moment for her because she realizes the who's the, she there to meet?
It looks like maybe an actor for her new film.
Was it that? I couldn't tell if it's that or like a, she was meeting for like a cinematographer or like a photographer, director of photography, because she's talking about a look that she wants to get. But this woman helps her appreciates like, you know, like, there's two ways you can do this. Like, you can either be with the woman or you can be watching her in this kind of voyeuristic way. And this, like, watching this waitress from inside out, I think, like, cements that what she wants to do is not tell a story about women misbehaving in porn, but just women in the world.
Yeah, and that discussion she had with Women Against Porn last episode, two episodes ago, I think she's been thinking about that. You know, that stuck with her. And then when she sees, you know, that this is sort of not just a story about the women in porn, this is also a story about women in general. She sort of generalizes her entire film.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, she uses this phrase at the end of this episode about, like, not letting the audience off the hook. She's like, you know, if I was doing it this way, I'm letting the audience off the hook. And it's almost like what she's realized is, what she's trying to do is fine, but it's like, you know, what is the target and what is the emotional reaction from the audience? Is the audience like, oh, those crazy fucking women, look at those whores do their thing? Or is it going to be, oh my God, something has to be done?
Yeah.
It looks like she's leaning towards the latter. It's unfortunate. So I don't know how much you want to go into this where she's got this actors and she's trying to walk them through this scene. They're doing a rehearsal and the one actor is unable to kind of get into the character's head. And Eileen kind of takes her and gives her this backstory, which is clearly about her, about, you know, I don't know how much you want to actually talk about the nuts and bolts of the scene, because it is the centerpiece, but it's also just really, really hard to walk through.
Yeah, and it stands on its own. Like, you see that scene, you know what's going on, you feel it.
Yeah.
All I can say is I hope that HBO submits it for the Baldies, because it'll probably win.
Well, I have some pull with those judges.
You do?
And I want to say that it's gonna have strong pull, strong polling with at least 50% of the voters. I thought the really interesting things are she points about, like, you know, her father and his relationship with the rules and like how you got to follow these rules. And there's these rules and there's like some rules are more important than others. But she has this experience where she, you know, breaks some rules, but, you know, she's going to hold these other rules sacrosanct. But her father doesn't.
Yeah.
And then abandons her over it. Mm-hmm. Which she really walks through the cascading realizations she had in that moment about, you know, what the lack of unconditional love and support. And it's
that part of it is personally as much as Paul calling his father in the last episode was personally devastating. This scene is personally devastating, not because I, you know, was a teenage whore or anything, or prostitute, but because, you know, some of those very same things applied to my relationship with my family, like those, that perception of who you are, the rules, right? These that they trump the unconditional love that you're supposed to have from a family, which is interesting to me because in one of those scenes when she's talking to Adam, she says, like, if you don't have your family, you've got nothing, or you're alone in this world. And she's kind of sort of pushing him away at the same time. She's trying to teach him a lesson. She's trying not to just be a bad mother and give him everything he wants, and like, but there's sort of a dichotomy there that she's embracing both sides of.
Yeah, it's almost like because that's one of the things I want to
talk
about.
Think is the best television, right?
It is complicated because I think she's simultaneously saying, I'm alone in the world.
Yeah.
And the world hasn't treated me very kindly. Mm-hmm. And she's talking to her son, who in context is, I think you're supposed to understand, is too high or discombobulated or just, you know, whatever to attend his own grandmother's funeral. The woman who raised him in many ways like his mother. And she's trying to say that maybe we could not do this. We could start fresh. We could, but you can't also.
But is a 18-year-old or whatever going to get that message? That's
no.
That's the tough thing. Like being,
because she's not her
delivering
father,
adult messages to children is a hard thing to do.
Right. I mean, I don't think she's her father. I think if Adam ever like sobered up and came to his senses and was down on his luck and needed a place to stay, that you know, she would, as long as he's, you know, going to start playing by the really important rules, that she would let him back into her life. And that's there where I was trying to get at the fact that, like, yeah, our experiences with, you know, there's rules in any religion, but like one of the big rules is like, you know, love should kind of cover all, and there's forgiveness. And when you find out that that's actually not the case, like your parents' personal reputation or embarrassment is much more important to them than like these so-called golden rules. Mm-hmm. It's tough.
I mean, that relationship is just totally shattered.
Yeah.
It's very hard to come back from that, which we see sort of with, I think, Melissa too, in a way.
So I guess like that's the thing that's a tragedy of Candy, is she knows what does and doesn't work.
Yeah.
And she, I guess, is going to put her trust in her son that he can figure it out, and that if he ever does, that she'll be there with him, and not in the way that like Melissa's father was there for him, where it's there with judgment and questions and how dare you embarrass me, but there with like, yeah, you got out and you got kicked in the face and maybe you learned a few things and like it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what she wished her father had said when he'd screwed up.
Yeah.
So she'd screwed up rather. There's also the moment that she has with Harvey at the end. Mm-hmm. So Harvey sees her give this like soul-searing speech to this actor, and it moves him. And this is on the back of him giving her $20,000 to kind of film this thing on the strength of, I guess, looking at the script or whatever. And he goes in for the kiss. Mm-hmm. And this is something that Alan Sepinwall has been tracking for the last couple of weeks. I guess
I have too, yeah.
So I didn't pick up on the fact that Harvey had feelings for her beyond the professional kind of like esteem.
Just been a look here or there.
Huh.
After certain events, and I don't recall exactly when it happened, but yeah, a couple episodes ago I think I picked up on this, and then here we are. And I don't really know how I feel about it. It's I think like it has been a long time coming.
Uh-huh.
Eileen clearly is not super surprised by it, and she's not resistant to it, at least not entirely.
But everyone involved knows this is a giant mistake from the moment it happens.
I think I think so.
Because this is like, you can't, like, this woman just gave this whole speech.
Or that wasn't a mistake, but mistakes are about to be made.
Huh.
Mistakes are very much about to be made. But I think you're right. Like, there is an element of this that is like, is this pity, right? Is this some kind of feeling of pity for Eileen that he's now feeling like he needs to come in and save her or something from that? Or is this respect for her as a creator? Because I could also see that. Like, he sees how beautiful of a movie she's writing here, right? And he has an actual respect of that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I don't know either. The way I took it is, it's one of these things where at the worst he's guilty of a read the room asshole kind of mistake. Like, this woman has just opened her soul and, you know, revealed something that is beautiful and vulnerable. And your first response as a man is, after you've given her a big sum of money, is... I find this attractive and it validates my respect for you. And now I'm going to kind of make this your problem when I know you're already dating someone else and you've already turned down money. Like if you're going to fuck the guys you're dating to get money for a movie, you would have done it. It's like that's the thing. And, you know, I think that's something that Candy's saying about the price tag that all women have in their bodies at all time is part of that, because like men's reaction to they find a woman attractive is to, you know, again, make it their problem. Even it's one thing if you're sitting at a bar and you're both cruising and you find an attractive woman, you hit up a conversation, fine, whatever. But like, you know, you hit on your employees, you hit on your babysitters, you hit on your daughter's friends, you do stuff like that. That's where everything gets all fucko. And I think that's what Harvey's done to their relationship.
Yeah, could be.
Especially, you know, if this happened like 5 years ago, I don't think it's the same response. But like, you know, Arlene's done a lot of development just this season, let alone in the past three. So I'm suspecting she's going to find a way to make the money to make the movie without his money now. But I don't know what that does to their professional relationship. I did like there's not a lot of comedic elements in the Deuce, but I did like him completely berating this director for fucking up the lighting and like him having him touch her him to get just an ounce of her directorial cheap directorial skills. And I also really liked we had talked about the other, I guess, thing going on, that her mother died.
Yeah.
And there's her at her funeral, and she's looking, she's got Harv on one arm and Hank on the other, and they're kind of supporting her. And there's the priest is saying that she gotta look to favor for those who are in mourning. And she looks across at her family and says amen, and then moves to, despite all the terrible things that we know that's gone on between her and her father, you know, she tries to give him a message of love and acceptance and kindness. Like, you know, she could say a million things in that moment, but she says, you really loved mom, and she knew that. Do we know why her aunt's got so much such an axe to grind against her, or is it just that's the stock her dad game from? Because I'm thinking, God, what a bitch. To get in the way between a father and his daughter during the death of the mother and wife, like, because you're his sister. Look, I mean, get the fuck out of here. All right, let's move on to the topic of, I threw all these three together because they're kind of intertwined: Vincent, Abby, and Rudy.
Oh, okay.
So Vincent demands a meeting. Well, he doesn't demand. He engineers to have a meeting with Rudy alone, and he's got a gun in his upper drawer. And I got the distinct feeling that if Rudy sits down and doesn't give him the answers that jives with Vincent's worksheet, he might just plug him then and there.
Yeah, So he's trying to feel him out to see. Because he's not at this point trying to see who killed Frankie. He knows who killed Frankie. Mm-hmm.
He's trying to see if who knew, like who, like if there any more people need to die. Who did?
Yeah,
who lied,
I guess he's
to
trying
him
to see if the whole drug thing was Rudy's idea, or.
And they make a whole point about like how loyal Vincent is, and I think that's where part of this is coming from. Like, I have been nothing but loyal to these guys, and if they're going to fucking lie to me about the death of my brother, then that's going to change how I feel about it. But I think it's kind of immaterial because Rudy dies at the end of this episode, is going to be super bad for Vincent.
I assume so, yeah.
But like, yeah, I thought that was weird. It's like, man, he's going to shoot him in his fucking peep show theater. And he comes home and you can tell like just how fucking emotionally exhausted he is by crossing these moral boundaries, by having all this distance between him and Abby. And he goes and falls asleep, gun in hand. There's all this friction between him and Abby. Abby finds this gun later and confronts Vincent with him. And he tries to pull... Oh, well, it's not he tries. This is like a fight that's been 5 years in the making, right? He doesn't try to deny anything, but he does try to turn it into like, well, you've got all your causes and you got all your fucking meetings. And you got all the women that you're financing their art funding. But the distraction between like... Their relationship's always worked on this trust thing. And... She can't trust Vincent to keep him safe. Like, why do you got a gun? Who killed your brother?
Or to not lie to her.
Like, or not to lie to each other, right?
He straight up lied to her in the last episode. And
continuing to lie to her.
Like, Vincent pointing the finger and saying, oh, you're never there for me, is hilarious because, you know, he's always in the clubs and always running his stuff, too. It's like, this relationship has not felt good for a long time, in my opinion.
So what do we think about how it is finally, disposition of this relationship as we head into the next episode?
I'll say I didn't quite understand it. Like, Vincent goes and he begs to have Abby back and tells her like, I love you, you're the thing I've always wanted. I don't believe Vincent.
I think he wants his ex-wife and his family back.
Yeah.
But he probably can't have that.
Uh-huh. So is Abby his version of settling? Like, that's fucked up.
I don't know, man. I look at this, and it's like one of those things where it doesn't make any sense, but it also does. Like, I understand why Vincent is doing this, because I understand his character. I understand what he's been through, and he is scared, and he needs some support and stability, and Abby's in a much better position to give that to him than his ex-wife. And it's but he's also lying to her because he's not going to get rid of that gun. They're not going to be safe. I mean, he's putting a lot of faith in Rudy to be the shield that protects him from all this. And it turns out that faith was not misplaced. It's just that Rudy himself didn't have the juice for it.
Yeah. Rudy, in my opinion, should have taken out Tommy. Like, I know that's a very different thing in their world,
right?
Than like
no, you're right. You're not right.
Most crime organizations, but like, come on.
So let's talk about this. Rudy learns from Vinny that Tommy Longo is the one that kind of was the drug connect, and importantly, also cut Rudy out of all this action. And Rudy didn't know that, and we knew, and Vincent believes him, so he gets out of that meeting. Then he goes to meet with Carmine. And this guy's wanting vengeance for his boy. And I thought Rudy was a stand-up guy. He's like, he made this out about like, I got this earner. I've already lost an earner. Now he wants me to have another earner for his coked up son. But then he gets to brass tacks. He's like, no, this isn't fair. My guy's always been right. He's been loyal. This cokehead killed his twin brother. He does what any man would do. So he puts his own seal. He's like, you know what? He actually asked me for permission on the hit, and I gave it to him. And there's also, notably, he's pretty frosty with Tommy here, too, even though he doesn't necessarily confront him.
Yeah, he all but just, like, shoulder checks him as he walks out of the place.
Yeah, so I don't know the gangster rules, and also the gangster rules are kind of like the pirate, you know, accords. They're, like, loose guidelines, but can Tony, this guy, come back on Vince now that he's killed Rudy? Because if Rudy takes responsibility and they clip Rudy...
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know the actual rules, but I would assume, it changes the equation because Rudy said, he went to the mat for Vincent and said, it's on me. So now that he's dead, maybe this whole thing needs to die with him, but...
Yeah, Tommy's thing is...
Tommy's a loose cannon sometimes.
Right. Yeah, so I want to talk about this death, but I want to still spend a little bit of time on this Vincent thing, because I mean, my understanding is that's probably the rule. That's kind of like the code of honor, but there's no, like, who's going to tell this guy, what's his name? Tony. Who's going to tell Tony that he can't have vengeance against the guy that actually killed his boy?
Yeah.
Well, he already killed Rudy. Yeah. But Rudy didn't pull the trigger. Well, Rudy gave permission. Yeah. But who's going to protect Vincent now? Tommy Longo, I guess, is probably going to inherit this crew.
Yeah, I don't think he gives a shit though.
Yeah, he doesn't. Now, they in the after credits, like kind of behind the scenes material, they talk about it, and the guy who plays Tommy mentioned that he's a sociopath, and that, and in a weird way, that him like getting things straight between him and Rudy like made it okay for him. It's like, oh, we got a clean slate. Now I don't have to feel bad to kill him.
Yeah.
But the thing is I felt like, did you not see tears in the guy's eyes when, like, in between first and second shots? Like, I felt like Tommy Longo, you know, and what part of him can be reached did feel a little sad for essentially kind of killing a father figure. Like, he's not going to not do it, but he had complicated feelings about doing it.
There was, I don't know about tears, but I definitely saw, like, a hesitation. Which to me says, because most of the times when you see a mob hit, it's just like, boom, boom, it's over and they're out.
Right.
This was very different.
There was at least a flash of emotion. And I've seen this guy kill people without any hesitation at all. So I don't know. It kind of bugged me that was that it's like when I hear the old actor, I feel like misinterpret the scene. It always gives me a little bit of what the cognitive dissonance here. I think that's so.
Well, let me ask you, do you think it's possible that Tommy had the okay from the boss, from Tony?
It's unclear, because that's the thing. I'm not sure if he's doing this to clean up his own act, if it's going to be like, oh, yeah, old man got robbed. He's sitting there flashing his cash. He's flashing his car. He's flashing his suits, and he's in the wrong neighborhood at the wrong time.
He said this was on him, so let's take him out.
It could literally go either way. It could be something that, because, you know, we know that Carmine went to Boss and talked about it. So there's definitely a vehicle that could have made that happen. To me, it seems like this is his last moment of weakness. Like, he could have saved himself if he had taken time, if instead of meeting him publicly, if he just met him and Tommy shows up and it's a room lined with plastic and he just bang, bang, bangs him, Rudy probably lives to gangster another 3 to 5 years at least.
Rudy's flaw, I think, is his belief in loyalty.
Yeah.
You know, like, he believes so strongly in loyalty, he doesn't even view this as a possibility. Once him and Tommy get right, that's the end of it in his mind. And they go back to how they were, but not in Tommy's mind.
I'm actually really surprised that Tommy... This is why I think this he had sanction on the hit, because I'm actually surprised that Tommy let himself get beat about the head and neck by Rudy if, you know, Rudy had so little power that Tommy just felt like he could take him out himself, you know? Why take that abuse if, well, I guess you're in public, but,
yeah, he clearly doesn't want anybody to know that he killed Rudy, cause he doesn't do it in public. He doesn't do it with anybody. He's all alone. Yeah. This is something he's not going to go pronouncing.
He even has a little subterfuge where it's like, oh, I got one last pocket, and he throws it out. It's like, he does that, like, you know, he throws the packet to kind of like distract Rudy so he can pull the gun on him and shoot him in the face. Like, huh, that's a lot of artifice I don't think he needed. I think you could just literally walked up and been, oh, hey, one more thing, kabang.
Yeah.
But there again, it felt like he was working himself up to it. I feel like it's a sanctioned hit. What would you say?
For interest sake, I'll say no.
Okay. You 50-50, huh?
Yeah, I am. I'm very up in the air on this.
Another kind of moment of levity is the Gene Chris, good cop, bad cop against the real estate guys.
Okay, I get most of what's happening here. They're moving on from the Deuce, right? They've got they've got other streets in the Times Square area they need to clean up. This group, this company that is sort of like organizing a lot of funds for the Koch campaigns or whatever he's using funds for, owns these properties. And so they can't really be gone after directly, in the same ways that like the therapist could.
They're politically untouchable because the therapist is, this is the difference between the truly wealthy people and the people to make a lot of money.
The powerful and the...
Right. And one of the tricks they play in this country is they pit guys like the doctor against guys like Bobby in the blue collar and think that, you know, make them think that they're the wealthy to talk about. No, these are the guys who have bought and paid politicians and they think they're going to be able to buy and pay laws. And I think they run up against what they think is maybe a slightly more immovable object, which is a well-connected politically well-connected black cop. It's like, hey, think how bad it'd be to, like, you know, exile this guy. And they kind of like turn to each other and look and be like, well, fuck, what are we going to do?
Yeah. And they play it like, I don't know if it's the police chief or what, the guy who's calling the shots here on whether to keep Chris in the field is the one who wants him there, and also, and this is all just totally a bluff,
right?
And also that I guess Koch doesn't have enough political capital at the moment because there's some other things going on that he doesn't want to risk, you know, whatever it would look like to push this thing through.
Yeah.
So what is the end? What is the end here? Are they just trying to get the right price? Like, that's what I wasn't sure about.
Yeah, they're just trying because they want to hold out for top dollar. The city can't. The developers won't move in if the property price is that high. So they're just trying to get them sell out low, and they're saying, hey, this detective is going to drag you through the mud and make do all the things he's done. There's nothing we can stop you. Yeah. There's nothing we can do to stop him. That's the lie. That's the only lie.
Yeah.
And it's like, I wondered, it reminded me of this situation I had like a year or two ago. I was talking to this contractor that was helping my mother-in-law remodel her house. So I couldn't fucking come back at him too much. He makes this offhand comment about his boy couldn't get into Rose Holman's engineering program because of affirmative action. He was pretty rude about saying it. And I'm like, So all of the graduating class of Rose Holman's engineering degree in 2024 or whatever is going to be all black dudes. Or is that what you're telling me? Like, is it possible, maybe just possible, that your boy just didn't make the cut?
Yeah.
But it's kind of like that. I feel like that this is like the rich people version of that, is like they believe in this racist system so much that like when it cuts back to them, it's like they don't even question it. It's like this makes sense to them, you know, so gotcha. They just go along with it. I don't know, it's a crazy scene, and I love the performance. I love like Gene like just being like, this guy, he's fucking vicious, he can't be touched.
Yeah.
And then they turn back to Chris and he's got that little hand wave and the smug face, and he's just, the way he's mean mugging him the whole time, and they're doing it back to him, it's great, and it's kind of high comedy. There's also a scene where Chris meets with Haddix, and Haddix wants out of Public Morals because it turns out all this stuff is working. There's not much.
Yeah, you're putting him out of a job.
You're cleaning up all the corruption, and he's not able to get by on a policeman's salary anymore. He wants a cushy job working hotel security.
Well,
I think to land so he can land in after he finishes out his time on the force.
Right.
So, and he wants to be moved to Intel or the Academy. I'm not sure what he means by...
He's angling for something easier. Just something where, you know, he's sitting behind a desk doing...
Yeah, he doesn't want to be... Nothing. He doesn't want to be beating the streets no more.
Yeah.
If you can't shake the streets down. And I don't know. It's just interesting to see Chris, who was uncorruptible...
Yeah.
Moonwalk himself into corruption, trying to do the right thing. And at no point, it's like boiling a frog. At no point, like, does any, like he's going to look back and see that every decision he made was just like a baby step towards, like, there's a continuum of, like, this is clearly right, this is clearly wrong. And some point he crossed over it and he doesn't even realize it because.
Yeah. And it's crazy to me that he doesn't, because Jack Maple is screaming it in his face every time they meet. Like,
but every single decision he makes is kind of like excusable because how far he's come and how close to their goal and how great it'll be. And like,
and as he gets farther and closer, everything, even bigger things, like
each
become
incremental
more excusable.
Lapse in judgment seems excusable, but all taken together. It's great. It's great, so because it explains so much of everything you see around, of like, you know, why does anyone like stand up and do something? Because like, what you're going, this is the thing you're going to stand up and fucking hit the streets on. But by the end, you know, we also see that people reach breaking points. Speaking of Paul, there's a great scene. All these scenes with Paul, like, are they're all a mess and they're blurry because I cried. And it hit the paper coming out of my ink. What kind of metaphor am I making here? I'm reading
my
notes on a screen.
Were you physically handwriting your notes?
Yeah. And I was sobbing over them, and they got tear streaked, Jim. I found these scenes moving.
Tears
and
are fine.
Highly
the
emotional.
Ink is what I'm worried about.
I got them on my LCD screen. It shorted out my monitor.
There we go. Okay, that's believable.
God, I got my metaphor finally. Finally insulated my masculine self with enough humor to admit that this shit actually caught me to the core.
Which part of it was it? Because
every
to
one
me,
of them.
It was the fucking photograph he has from 1981.
Yeah.
4 years ago, where this dude is the only guy left.
Yeah.
Out of the entire group photo.
And it's funny because, like,
fucked up.
At first I was like, huh, this piano player is like a notch below who I'm used to watch, the talent I'm used to watching. But then I realized he was the writer a couple episodes ago in the behind the scenes talking about how many friends he's personally. So he's a longtime collaborator with David Simon. He's a writer. He's not a professional actor. And I immediately forgave him for all that because he's doing a good job.
I didn't think he was bad,
In all things considered. But yeah, that's the kind of like shit that they've been serving this whole season, of just like, what a tragic and unreal experience it was to live through that. And how Paul's kind of like a little whistling past the graveyard. You know, it's like he doesn't want to see if he doesn't want to actually get tested to see, but he's assumed that he's dead. He's wanting to leave money to some political causes, but he's also tired of politics. And he's kind of got that, I think, complaint that we've all had at one point in our lives, if we've made a decision to get, like, you know, involved, is that like, God, why should we have to? We pay people to do these things.
Yeah.
And I thought Carl's response back was like, how many times did you see your boyfriend in this play about standing up, you know, about concentration camps and Nazis, and you still say that shit. And his advice was like, whether you die or not, when you go out, make a noise, because if people can look away, they will.
Yeah.
And you see that in so many things, you know, if people can look away, and, you know, people complain about protesting, people complain about demonstrations, people complain about things getting violent at them. But like, if these gay men had just gone silently into the graves, you know, the AIDS crisis has been a lot worse. We wouldn't be so close to, you know, finding a cure. We've essentially, I think, assuming you have this the financial wherewithal, we have essentially a cocktail that you can take and stave off AIDS forever, which is remarkable. And it wouldn't have happened, and none of the progress we'd had in gay rights would have happened had these guys not taken to the streets. And he does choose to get active. He goes to Abby and entrusts all of his property to her and says, if I die, I want you to liquidate it all and give it to the GMHC, which is the Gay Men's Health Crisis, which is was founded in this era to, you know, raise awareness and provide health care to men with AIDS, and still active to this day. It's funny, though, because Rudy getting clipped is kind of overshadows this, too.
Yeah, I mean, he did have a piece of that club.
Yeah.
And the baths, I assume.
Private piece of all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I wonder if they would just like pressure Abby not to sell because it's still making money, or if they just want their cut of it. I'm not sure exactly how that's going to screw things up, but it's going to.
Mm-hmm.
What did you make of the scene where Gene meets Paul at one of the bathhouses and was flirting with him?
And yeah, but it's also just a meeting of old friends again, like, because they apparently hadn't seen each other in a while.
Do people, this is something that Alan Sepinwall wrote in his Stones review. Do people know about Gene working for the Koch campaign? Koch?
It's Koch.
Okay, Koch campaign.
Yeah. It's not like Coke. It's not a hard CH. It's not. Yeah, okay. I can't make these jokes. All right. where were we?
What do we make of this? Do people know about Gene's relationship? Because like, everyone is furious at the mayor.
It's a good question.
So I thought that Paul's up to something. Like, somehow that Paul is going to help Gene appreciate that he is a part of this community as much as he doesn't want to be. I had the idea that like Paul might try to deliberately infect him to get him kind of on board.
That'd be fucked up,
and it'd be a spicy way to take the story, for sure.
Yeah, maybe too spicy. I mean, first to have a human plea with him, you know, just like have a conversation with the man before you go give him AIDS to get him involved in your cause.
I'm just saying there was significant looks, and there's this whole like, hey, it's okay, as long as we're safe, right? And you know, the same way I saw, Frankie probably gonna die, Rudy probably gonna die, like, I feel like I'm picking up on these threads, and there's something to it. Now
you might be right.
I might be jumping way to some other conclusion, and they're hinting at something else, but
I don't know. To me, this, I read nothing more from this scene than a meeting of two old friends who had a lot weighing on them.
Because the other thing is, it could go, I guess, is if, you know, Paul doesn't know his relationship to the campaign and he finds out later, it's just something to be a massive betrayal. So it could just be like, you know, if they eventually have feelings for each other, then it's, you know, that's the fulcrum that he, because something's got to get Gene into the game. Something's got to get Gene into something besides just cleaning up the streets.
Know that Gene just has a lot of political power in general and maybe try and figure out a way to use that to the advantage of the gay community.
Yeah. Well, and there's also, I guess it's nice just to fill out that, like, you know, it's not like everyone in the gay community are heroes. You know, there's plenty of collaborators, sellouts, people looking the other way, people wanting to protect their position and their health, because it's not their problem that people weren't careful. I maybe that's what they're trying to get along or to communicate there too. I just had a lot of question marks with their meeting there. And then Paul decides, after he gets his kind of last will and testament settled with Abby, that he's going to take to the streets and joins the fights. There's cops that kind of provoke a violent response with a few unkind words to the protesters. And Paul winds up in jail.
Mm-hmm.
But looks like he's significantly less haunted than the beginning of this episode.
Yeah, because he feels like he is making a noise, right?
Yeah. And I, like I said, I'm going to leave out the parts that I probably couldn't recap without getting weepy, because all the stuff about his, you know, the ritual of giving all the old photos and the weeks before a person dies. There's actually a lot of things I thought with burial.
Stuff with Abby.
With burial customs that were kind of moving. Like, I appreciated, like, Harvey and Hank, you know, introducing Eileen to the Jewish concept of, like, laying stones and sitting Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
This custom of everybody. And it's something that, like, Paul is, like, not upset with, but kind of exasperated with. Like, you know, these people telling me things about my lover that I don't already know. But it's probably
I'm going to forget,
yeah. And also, like, then after that's already sweet and touching, he says it's kind of like a, you know, tears in the rain moment, like, what happens when I die? Like, you know, like, we're treating each other as like these holders of memories, these vessels of recollection, but what happens when, you know, you lose entire, like, branches of the trees of these communities when these people are dying? I hope Paul gets a happy ending.
So do I, man. I
feel like by Deuce stands, they're almost teasing it. Like, the fact that he's so certain that it's the inverse of like Frankie. You know, it's like he's so certain he's going to die that I almost think he's not gonna.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. They could punch me in the gut again too. Do you want to talk about Bobby?
Okay, and Black Frankie and the parlors and, like, just kind of all of it.
Bobby's management woes.
Yeah.
Tommy Longo, Bobby's just trying to, like, hey, you know, I'm light, because I got some problems with my employees. And Tommy Longo's like, well, fix it. And then he goes and bellows at the girl that works the bar and Dr. Frank. You got your demand, fix it. So Dr. Francis goes fixing. Mm-hmm. He goes and meets with the sex workers that have gone run off, and they've set up shop at the hotels. And he's like, hey, this line is like, you know, I had the pussy, Bobby had the beepers. Now I have both the pussy and the beepers. And she says, you're taking too much and doing too little for it. And he goes, what? Well, we provided the transportation and the security. She's like, I got taxes and hotel security, and I'm paying them a fraction of what we paid you.
Yeah, and then he goes back to Bobby and says, we got to negotiate with these girls. What leverage do they have? What possible offer can they make here?
The only thing I can think of is they can provide, like, the really upscale access to the really upscale high rolling, because he said we've got the contacts with these, like, high rolling Wall Street types. So, like, you know, yes, you might take more of the money if you're an independent contractor, but you'll have more money if you work for me.
Yeah, and those Wall Street guys have the money.
The way Bobby views this as a union man, where he's like, why don't these women shut up and take their instruction from me? And then when they point out, it's like, well, didn't they just unionize on their own? Isn't this what one of those job actions you guys are always talking about? And he instantly comprehends where he's at and smashes that mirror. I thought it was so fucking funny. But yeah, that's it. This is David Simon explaining why unions are a thing, why we should support them, why you need strong to make an economy work, and we'll see if people listen.
And if you want more of that, go watch this actor in season 2 of The Wire.
Yes.
Because that's all about that stuff.
Yep. Okay, Lori. This is the last kind of checklist or character we need to check into. So she's meeting with Greg in their kind of sad little production offices that he's got running. I think that there's a lot of things that concern me about his operation. Number one, this office looks a lot bigger than he needs. Number two, there's dudes just standing around playing golf in the background. Mm-hmm. I bet they're taking salary.
Yeah.
And he's explaining to Lori how, like, it's just a rough environment. No one's wanting to make porn because there's a glut in the market, and it's all about distribution, and we just have to survive, and you got to go out there and and ominously show them something they haven't seen before.
I meant to go look up when the first gangbang was, but I got distracted by Mr. Robot.
Surely it's before 1985. Maybe it's like one of those things where it starts in the like rain cutter or raincoat gutter area of porn,
yeah,
and then it eventually like the star performers are forced to do it because that's what the market wants.
Right, it's like Frankie's amateur stuff, right?
Yeah,
and then everything kind of goes toward amateur.
Yeah, and she has this scene where she says, "Can we buy back my movies, start a mail order business, and I can do autograph a model that we know from Frankie would absolutely work."
Uh-huh.
And he just pushes a tray of Coke towards her.
Yeah. Yeah. It felt to me like, okay, when he talks about break even, Laurie is his break even. And mm-hmm. then the other people he's got on his roster are the profit. And they're not up and running yet. And so he's kind of leaning on her and just keeping her numb and out of the loop and just trying to use the last bits of her career to spawn off an entirely new company with the first bits of other people's careers.
No,
it's kind of fucked.
He's treating her like a pimp.
Yeah.
Like Laurie's his bottom bitch. And mm-hmm. I think it's this, was it The Deuce or some other movie I watched where they talk about this pimp that wrote this book, and he talks about like, you know, a seasoned pimp can look at a woman and know how many fucks she's got in her. And
I think it was I think it was this show.
Yeah, I thought it was like, it was from like one of the pimps talking in season one.
Mm-hmm.
And like Greg is sized up Laurie and knows that she's kind of running at the end of her rope, and he's mm-hmm. already got the younger, blonder, bigger titted version of Laurie ready to take her place. And she has got he's used kind of like what little pathetic nest egg that she had built up. She had 20-30 grand.
Yeah.
Completely plowed that into this probably failing, you know, production company. Mm-hmm. But if it succeeds, it's not going to be, you know, on Laurie's product.
No, that's a shame of it. Like when she's saying, give me my money back, like I very much felt like she wanted to go do the thing she said,
yeah,
just buy herself back from this fucking industry,
yeah,
and become her own brand. And that's not possible now.
Yeah. I wonder how did she end up with Greg? Like, why did Kiki steer her towards that? Is it something that
wasn't
she felt
like
she needed?
Is it a party or something they met at? Like last season,
because I'm thinking like if she had done like an Eileen, but that's, you know, there you're talking about like, you know, you're blaming a person for trusting the wrong people,
oh,
instead
sure, yeah,
of the system that's tricking them and grinding them up. There's all kinds of sketchy shit, like since there's so many cop raids in the LA area, they're doing this like extreme secrecy. So Laurie is forced to get into the world's first bang bus, where she gets in and she sees there's 12 dudes in her. And that's her first indication something's going to go wrong. And it's also wrote in my notes, more enforcement equals less safety for women, because now instead of being driven to a set where she knows where she's at and she can get out of there if she needs to, mm-hmm. she's going to be whisked to a location that she doesn't even fucking, if they didn't provide her a phone. The only difference between what happened to her and like rape is that she had a phone call where her agent mm-hmm. kind of like managed the situation and feelings for her.
Yeah.
But it's pretty, I mean, Jesus Christ, she shows up here and no one takes her seriously. Like, it's just everyone knows, yeah, you're going to kick a fuss and you're going to make some delays. You're going to smoke your cigarette, but you're also going to do this gangbang. Because what else are you going to do? I mean, the director, makeup girl even was kind of like, you know, like crossing her arms and like, okay, let's, you know, it's like no one took her seriously on the set.
Yeah. I mean, that's been true for this entire season.
Right.
She's been getting pushed around.
End result is Laurie fires Kiki. She goes home to Greg and he's fucking the younger, blonder, bigger titted version of herself.
Mm-hmm.
She does the thing where she cuts him. And as she's walking out into the night, he says, I made you. Where the fuck are you going to go? First of all, like, it's so identical to what Cece screamed at her. And yeah, the fact that, like, how did you make her? She literally moved out here on the back of her making her own career.
Yeah, she made you, dude.
Yes.
Like,
yeah,
if your company ever does anything, it's because of her.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know where the fuck she's going to go, because mm-hmm. I think from my understanding is she has zero money.
Yep.
Do you think she's going to end up back on the Deuce?
She could.
I mean, that's the way to, like, if you got two episodes to wrap things up and you want to get everybody in the same location. I don't know. because it like the thing is like I feel like if it wasn't for her earlier experience going out to New York, that would be the logical play to make. But I felt like she, I don't know, she's in a different spot than the last time she went to the Deuce.
Yeah, she's definitely desperate now.
Yeah, but I don't know. Maybe her and Eileen can work together. Eileen will have a part for her in this
movie.
Well,
see, I thought that's what was going to happen last time, but
yeah,
it didn't.
Well, she went to Vincent. Well, yeah. She went to Vincent's dumbass instead of Eileen's. So, oh, I forgot. Yes, we have. There's a miscellaneous section where there's just a few bullet points for characters that we get like a scene or two on.
Yeah.
Let's talk Big Mike, Dr. Mike, Dr. Michael.
Yeah, he's got HIV.
Yeah.
There's not much they can do about it at this point. Why doesn't he say anything to Vincent? He just kind of walks out of the club. Like, I get it. It's a big development in your life and or death, but like, I thought you and Vincent were pretty tight.
It probably just seems so pointless.
Yeah.
You know, how is Vincent going to explain? How's he going to explain? He, you know, he might be embarrassed to tell Vincent about like his experiences and, you know, like that, because like that's the thing that always hung in the air. It's like, oh, isn't this a gay man's disease? And how does Big Mike see himself in the kind of queer world he moves around in? And even if how he sees himself, you know, lines up with how he actually is he going to want to tell that to other men that he respects? Is it just pointless from like, you know, we've had this kind of like big extended adolescent fucking around with this guy and now I'm dying and I know how it's going to end. Do I want to waste any breath on this bullshit? I don't know. It's interesting and it's hard to say because he doesn't give Vince or us anything.
No, I don't know where he's going. I don't know if we're ever going to see him again. I assume not at this point.
He looked like he aged 10 years since Frankie's death, man. They really did it up on the makeup on him. But that sucks and is surprising. I wouldn't have guessed you know, at the beginning of the season that because he's, you know, Big Mike's always been invincible. Let's talk about Melissa, or Margaret, as she's calling herself now. She comes home to her true home, back to New York City. She said 10 minutes into New Jersey, she knew that she'd made a mistake because her dad intellectually knew the things he had to do to have a fresh start with her, but he just can't move past the questions of why and how. And
he couldn't move past it in those 10 minutes that I spent with him in that car ride back. Come on.
It's been a couple months, though, to be fair. Like, I think in Showtime, like, every episode skips forward a month or two.
Okay, so she knew in 10 minutes it wasn't going to work, but then she spent a couple months.
She still tried, because also Reg has gone from covering. That's the other thing. Like, Reg has gone from covering for Todd to needing to be covered for himself.
Yeah.
Because, of course, you got to work until the day you fucking die. Because there's nobody looking out for you. They talk about this concept of dry drunk, which I've never heard of before.
That somehow lingers with you?
I guess it's something that they throw around a lot in 12-step programs to describe a person who has stopped drinking but has not made any other life choices. Like, they're still hanging around the same people. They're still hanging around.
Yeah, they're just relying on their willpower to keep them
white-knuckling it. So, they still, they're not sleeping right. They're not healthy. They're worried, and they're in that. They're setting themselves up for failure. Because in all other respects, they're acting like an addict. And it's interesting, a person like, because we know that her father also was trying to get sober. He's like 2 years sober, but like white knuckling the concept of being a parent.
Being a decent human being.
Seeing that your children are adults and they can make mistakes just like you. And I thought it was an interesting concept to apply to him. Then we see a scene of like Loretta obsessing over her makeup. Like, she gets dolled up and then she wipes some of it off. You're like, what's going on? But then we find out she's meeting her sweetheart's mom for the first time.
Yeah, why do I care about this? This scene didn't seem to need to be in the episode to me.
I think it's nice. As I related to this, like when I got out of the cult, like I was involved with ex-cult stuff for a good while. And then eventually I let that stuff go too, because I felt like that was the final step of me kind of recovering.
Yeah.
And like her getting involved with the women against pornography and then kind of seeing the folly of like that extremist take. And now she's like trying to just live a good life for herself. I feel like maybe, okay. You know, I don't know, because that's the thing. It's like, you know, what is your obligation to a community that you got out of? Like, what is, you know, do you have to like be in anti-porn causes your entire life? Do you have to advocate for sex workers until the day you die? Is that like, are you not allowed to have a happy life? And that's a moral question everyone's got to ask themselves. But like, it is nice to see her maybe trying to shoot for something where she can have a normal kind of happy life. But I don't know.
I mean, I want that for her. I don't know. It seemed oddly out of place in this episode.
It's like him. Yeah. It's like they're trying to do a lot in this last season.
Yeah.
And I think that this is one of those potential trajectories these women can take.
Sure.
You know, like is she going to be like the Bubbles of this story?
But I feel like we've seen this before, right? Like we've seen Darlene. Is Darlene? The woman who's trying to become a nurse.
But like I'm thinking like all the women we've seen escape the deuce, and like then they've wound up murdered. They've wound up like Darlene is like she's hitting this glass ceiling because of her experience. Like as Melissa kind of, and Eileen, you know, she smashed through that glass ceiling into stratosphere. We know how rare that is. Is like Melissa kind of like an average case, a best case, kind of like, you know, like a more normal, non-disastrous after porn career.
Yeah, could be.
But yeah, it's a one bullet point in a very busy episode.
Yeah.
We do have a piece of feedback, which you can send in to tv@baldmove.com. Brian L. says, wondered if anyone is keeping track of porn stars today after they age out of the industry. There's a series of documentaries on Netflix called After Porn Ends, where they check in with male and female porn stars who made it big at one time and what they're up to now. It kind of runs the gamut of people who live totally normal lives, to people having a hard time now, to people who are still in porn in some capacity, like being behind the camera or hosting a sex talk show on satellite radio. Anyway, I found it interesting and I thought I'd share it with y'all and the fans of the Deuce. Interestingly enough, I saw After Porn Ends 2. I saw the sequel because it was on Netflix and it was like, it popped up and I had like exactly 40, I think it was like an hour and a half, and I had exactly that much time. And it, like Lisa Ann was on the cover, a porn star of some note in the last few years. And I'm like, fuck it, play. And I really enjoyed it. This was like 2 or 3 years ago, but I'm also, when I was reading Brian's email, I was thinking about that through the lens of like what Eileen was talking about a voyeuristic experience or whether, and I'm like, After Porn In seems much more like the looking through the keyhole than you actually being with people.
Yeah.
You know, because it's kind of like, oh, this person's successful and this person got AIDS and is dying. And this person, it was kind of like just gawking at these adult stars.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. It's interesting because this season is also, I feel like when I first saw Cowspiracy, this documentary that really started having me evaluate like how I felt about eating meat. And like this season of The Wire is doing this to me with pornography because like I was like,
oh no,
I came in. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'm, no, 43 years. Am I have to go
your
cold
other
turkey
cow?
Exactly. Meat and porn. It's the pillars of my masculine identity. But seriously, because I went into the series thinking like, oh, well, the salvation of porn is going to be like more female producers and more feminist porn. And also like, look at all the amateur sites like Minivids and, you know, the amateur section of Pornhub where people are like, you know, doing stuff of their own volition. And but then as this I'm watching this season, like I've noticed something like like even women are producing this stuff for themselves, like there's still another boss in the room, which is the free market.
Mm-hmm.
And like when I'm looking at the front page of some of these sites, maybe they're just a lot of women and having 3 foot, they're just genuinely in having 3 foot dildos shoved down their throats until their like neck is literally bulging. And maybe there's women they're in like drinking gallons of piss. I don't think there's this many women into it. So okay. Why the fuck are they doing it, Jim? Are they doing it because they love it? Are they doing it because that's what's paying the bills?
I don't know. I also don't know why people watch that, frankly. Like, I'm not a fan.
Because it's because men want and will pay for it. That's
right.
So like, I feel like I'm mind fucking myself because there's no, like, so And the far left, they have this phrase they like to trot out called "there's no ethical consumption under capitalism." Mm. And what they mean by that is kind of like, you know, when rumors is like edgy, when like Louis C.K. said like 5 or 6 years ago, "You guys, you know, we're all progressive in this country, but we all use iPhones and are essentially made by child slaves in China or India or whatever." Mm. And we're all like, "Haha, that's funny. We're in denial, but everyone's still using smartphones." Mm. Like, because, you know, if you made a smartphone in America with American labor, it costs $5,000, and who's going to do that? I'm feeling the same thing about porn, is that, you know, like, there is no way to ethically consume this because the market itself is perverting the shit, you mm-hmm. know, and making people do things they don't want to do and probably don't feel good about. Or I don't know, maybe I'm overly morally reacting to this. It's just David Simon's fucking up with my politics again. It's point blank period what I'm saying.
I think that's what he's trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah, no ethical porn consumption under current capitalism. So, what am I going to do?
I don't know, man. I guess you'll have to
text erotica.
Find another hobby.
Text erotica?
Yeah.
Erotic fan fiction?
Virtual porn.
Virtual porn.
Yeah, like no real humans were involved in the making of this porn.
Yeah.
All digital characters.
Get Carrie Fisher and Peter Cushing.
Because
we have highly detailed, realistic models of them and have them smashed. There's no one being exploited there.
And the dude, and we can get maybe Robert Downey Jr. after this.
Yes,
next one. Yeah.
Yes, we have a whole library of models that we can use.
And with
deep
fakes, we're about to be to the point where we don't even need porn actors.
Mm.
We'll just I don't know. Figure it out.
So there'll be millions of porn actors out of work out on the street.
Yeah.
Automation will replace them, Jim. I'm not feeling good about this either. all right, well, maybe we'll figure it out in the next 2 weeks. Send in your feedback to tv@ballmove.com if you'd like. We will be here next week to discuss the final episodes of The Deuce. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.